Steve Lillywhite joins us at the World Cafe to produce monthly Lillywhite sessions from Avatar Studios in New York City. He's had a career that any record producer would envy. He's worked with everyone from Peter Gabriel and the Pogues to Crowded House and the Dave Matthews Band. And in 2005, he was heralded as Producer of the Year at the Grammy Awards. And then there is Lillywhite's work with U2, which helped him earn his other four Grammys. On the group's more recent discs, Lillywhite has been called in at the final stages, but his relationship with the band actually goes way back. Lillywhite helmed the creation of their first three albums, 1980's Boy, 81's October, and 1983's War. I asked Steve how he got the job producing U2's debut when they were still unknown.
It actually all starts off with Joy Division. Joy Division had a producer called Martin Hannett, who produced a song called 11 O'Clock TikTok for U2, and I think he was slated in to do the album. Now, Ian Curtis, the singer of Joy Division, committed suicide, and Martin Hannett took this very badly. He was part of Factory Records, and Joy Division, it was all part of this Manchester thing. And Martin Hannett decided that he didn't want to produce Boy, because he was, you know, there were problems. So the band then went back to their list of producers, and I was on there. And so they contacted me, and they said, Island Records said, we'll fly Steve over to see a gig. Now, I'd never been to Ireland before. I was told that I would be met at the airport by a man called Mr. McGuinness. Now, my idea of Ireland, I thought there would be this man in a tractor with sort of straw coming out of his ears to pick me up, Mr. McGuinness. And of course, I got to the airport and it was, hello, Steve, Paul McGuinness here. You know, wow, you know. So we got in the car, and it was probably like an hour's drive to the gig. And Paul, I was amazed by his enthusiasm and his absolute love for this band. He would be playing me these songs that they'd recorded, really bad sounding, but, you know, it didn't matter. His job was to sell this band, you know, and that's what I love about Paul. He's never once made a creative decision. It's like, you make those decisions, I'll do the business. So we got to the gig, and there were these four very shy boys. I mean, Larry Mullen was 17 years old, and the gig was pretty good. It was very strange, though, because all the boys were at one side of the hall and all the girls were at the other side. It was some sort of, they're only about 18 years old, or, you know, all the kids, it was very Irish. And, you know, this was before Ireland was the wonderful multicultural country it is now. So we talked and decided that I would do a single to see how it goes. So I went over to Dublin again, and we recorded one song, which was called A Day Without Me. I didn't think it was that good, but the band didn't have anyone else. The single wasn't a hit either, but they said, you know, we would like you to produce the album. So I was very lucky, did the first album, which, you know, and the great thing about Paul McGuinness, the manager, is how he got them to tour America. He made the right connections over here. He got the right agent, and they just toured their butts off. And, you know, but at that time, they had a passion, but it was not that focused, you know. But also for me at the time, I felt that I was doing a lot of different bands, and I felt it was not right for a band to only work with one producer. And I really felt that you two would benefit from working with someone else. So I said, look, you know, I love you guys, but you should try someone else. And they said, no, we want you. So, all right. So I went and did October, right, which was definitely, you know, the first album was the songs that they'd gigged. The second album, they didn't have any songs, really. And so we sort of made it up in the studio, and I think Bono was having trouble exactly finding the right words. He had some lyrics stolen while he was on tour. So subsequently, people tell me October's a very spiritual album.
At the time, it did not get as good reviews as Boys.
No, it didn't. You know, a song that's the only lyric is Rejoice, it's not going to get people who write reviews going to write good reviews on that. On Boy, it was quite open. On October, they sort of shrunk. They went into their shells a little bit. They were confused about their spirituality and how to marry that with the rock and roll world that they had witnessed after touring Boy, because they came from Ireland. It was very, they didn't know much about the world. So when it came to the War album, I said, look, guys, you should definitely, you know, you need to work with a different producer, you know. And they said, yes, you're right. They went off and they did a bit of recording with a couple of different people. And then I get a phone call saying, Steve, what are you doing in September? I said, well, nothing. And they said, well, you know, we'd love you to come and do this album. So I went over, and I remember that just before recording the album, we all went on holiday together. In fact, no, I went with Paul McGuinness and Adam. We went to Tuscany, and Bono and Larry went somewhere. Edge stayed in Dublin and worked on music. So when we went in the studio, the only real song that they had was Sunday Bloody Sunday, and which was pretty much Edge's song. So we went in and recorded, started this album. For me, it was the first record I did with them with a click track. Basically, I'd been experimenting around that time with playing to a click. I don't know, it's maybe a bit technical for everyone. I mean, you know, instead of just playing live, you put a tempo down and you play along. Now, for a drummer, that is it's a whole different way of looking. A drummer like Keith Moon, for instance, would never be able. His time is nothing to do with a click. And Larry, up until that album, he was always rushing. You know, that was the mood of their music was whoosh like that. And I said to him, look, why don't you try this? So I remember sitting with Larry for a whole day for Sunday Bloody Sunday, just getting in his headphones with the click and him going, ba-da-da-da-dum, dum-dum-dum, da-da-dum, dum-da-da-dum. But he would do it so fast that he would race against the click. And I'd say, no, just, you know, and just really, I spent ages just teaching him and, you know, getting like that. And then all of a sudden he got it, you know, and it was great. We should maybe play that song.
Yes.
Sunday Bloody Saturday. Maybe one of my, I listened to it earlier today, and maybe I shouldn't have had quite so much violin in it. Mm-hmm. It's funny, I hadn't realised there was this guy, local guy, who we got in to play violin on it, and the violin's right at the very beginning, and I would have used the violin more of as a texture on top of the band rather than something that was so prominent early on in the song.
Now, you confessed when you came in that you had not listened to this probably since you made it.
No, I hadn't. Their life is too short to sit around going, aren't I great or aren't I crap?
Yeah.
You know, so...
Which are your two choices, aren't there?
Those are your two choices. You either say I'm great or I'm crap, and one of them makes you complacent and one of them makes you uncertain. Mm-hmm. So I don't really want either of those two things. So I did listen to it, and there were some moments on the record I thought were really special, and some other moments where I went, oh my goodness, did we really put a trumpet solo on that song? I'd forgotten. another funny story about Sunday Bloody Sunday. We were playing back the record to the promotion guy from the record company who'd come over, and he goes, that song's a hit, but just get rid of the bloody, you know, because in England it's you know, it's a sort of slightly swear word, and he didn't even realize what the song was about, the Bloody Sunday in Northern Ireland. But anyway,
there you go. What else should we listen to on this? What do you think?
Well,
would be,
I mean, New Year's Day, when I listened to it earlier, I thought, yeah, this is a great song. And in fact, it's funny, when you make an album, you know, I'm sure people have said this to you before, but each song is like one of your children. And, you know, it's ridiculous to even consider having a favorite child because, you know, you love all your children for all multitude of different reasons and stuff. So when we were working on this record, you know, you put as much love and attention into each song. So sometimes you're a little bit blind to which ones would be. I always think, you know, when you finish an album, it's like a horse race. All horses are there at the beginning. They're all even. But of course, as time goes on, some songs lead the race and some, you know, and others. And I remember this, you know, I didn't know that New Year's Day was any better than Red Light. You know, but there was this one kid in the studio who was sitting at the back, and he was like an intern, you know, and he would just always, New Year's Day, that's the song, that's the song. We go, really? You know, but we like blah, 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 blah. Actually, I think it's one of Adam Clayton's finest moments. This song is led by the bass. It's like when guitarists pick up the guitar, they go, dun, 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 dun. They do Smoke on the Water or something, and a bass player will pick up his guitar and go, dun, 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 and they'll play New Year's Day.
New Year's Day from War, and we're talking about War with the album's producer, Steve Lillywhite. We're doing Lillywhite sessions on the World Cafe, and we are also going to be taking a look at some of the classic albums that he's produced over the years as we go along. And, okay, and those are obviously two of the biggest songs, the two biggest songs on the record. What's another one that you, one of those horses that was even at the,
It's the starting gate. And funnily enough, when I listened to the record coming in today, this one actually really moved me. Drowning Man. It's I don't remember too much about the recording of it, but it's got this really good atmospheric thing about it. You know, I mean, I think Bono was in a sort of a desperate state. I remember doing the recording of the record, and not so much for this song, but Bono always saying to Edge, don't be like the Edge, be more like Mick Jones from The Clash, you know, because Edge will surround himself with wonderful atmospheric sonics, and Bono wants him to rock, you know. He felt that maybe October was so landscapey that you know, that they were a rock band, and he wanted more visceral in your face sounds, but this was a song that actually is not that, and I thought it was really beautiful.
That's Drowning Man, another one from War, finishing up our look at the classic U2 album with Steve Lillywhite. And I can't wait to see what you pick next. It'll be interesting as we go through these, because you've had so many songs that everybody knows so well, and we'll see what's next.
Next album.
Yeah, what do you think?
I don't know. I'm a big fan of the Pogues. I mean, I did a great album with the Pogues called If I Should Fall from Grace with God, and I think that's a special record.
Well, we'll do that next time. Steve, right. Thanks a lot for bringing this in. Thanks a lot for producing it.
Oh, thank you.
Steve Lillywhite, our guest here on the World Cafe.